Hello, my name is Mike Consul. I'm a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute, and I write an economics blog called Rorty Bomb, and I am very happy to be joined by Arthur Goldhammer. Could you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Art Goldhammer, and I'm very glad to be here with Mike.
Excellent. And you are a translator of many books, including one book that I'm holding up here, Capital, by Thomas Piketty, I think is the right way to say it.
Piketty.
Excellent. Yeah. So why don't you give us a little bit about your background. How did you end up translating books? And is translating books like a really fun job? It seems very cool.
Well, I've certainly had a good time with it over the past 37 years. But my past is rather checkered. I started out as a physicist and a mathematician, and in fact took a PhD in mathematics at MIT. But during my time in graduate school, I was drafted in 1968 during the Vietnam War, and because I spoke French, the Army decided I would be a good candidate to learn Vietnamese. So I spent something like 6 months in Vietnamese language school, and then some additional time in intelligence training school, and was sent to Vietnam in 1968. That changed my thinking about a lot of things. And when I came back, I did return to graduate school and pursued my studies, took my PhD, and taught mathematics for several years. But my heart was no longer in it. I wanted to pursue other interests. I had always been interested in literature and in various aspects of the humanities while I was studying math and science. So when I came back from Vietnam, when I finally decided to make the break with mathematics in 1975, I went to Paris to live and spent a couple of years there. And when money began to run out, I naturally decided to turn to translating as a way to earn a living because I spoke French quite well by that point.
Wow. And so that would have put you in the 70s. What kind of math were you studying?
Algebraic topology. My thesis is on differentiable manifolds, which was a fashionable subject back in the 70s.
Wow. I remember my undergrad degree is in math, and I remember I tried to take a graduate-level combinatorics class because it was the late 90s, and you know, math and CS was very popular. It still is, obviously. And I realized that there was just that break where I was not going to function at the graduate level, and you know, my life ended up okay, so it's not a big thing. But it was like, wow, that's a whole other ballgame when you get to that level. But
That's right. What I found was that I had many interests, and I was able to pursue those many interests while I was in school and graduate school. But when you get to the professional level, you have to dedicate yourself to one thing. And I decided it wasn't math that I wanted to dedicate myself to.
And so you started translating books and started to work in that capacity. Right now, you're obviously a very prestigious academic translator. How did that transition go? Is that a lot of luck, or did you kind of pursue an academic translation career, or how did you get from there to here?
Well, there was a certain amount of luck involved. I was fortunate enough to have a friend in Paris who was working as the assistant to Michel Crozier, a prominent French sociologist who had just finished a book that he wanted to have translated. But because he spoke English well, he wanted to supervise the translation. So it was convenient for him to have somebody who was in Paris. And since I knew his assistant who recommended me, he was willing to take a chance on me, even though I had no experience. And that got me connected with the University of Chicago Press and with an editor named Doug Mitchell, who had signed up quite a number of prominent French historians at that point. But he had had very little luck finding a translator who could handle that type of work. When he got my translation of Crozier, he decided to try me out on those historians. And the backlog of books that he had built up kept me working for a number of years. In the meantime, I became connected with the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, and that gave me access to a number of scholars to whom I could turn for advice when I had questions about technical aspects of this or that work. So in those several respects, I was quite lucky.
Now, you know, I don't know. I don't have a good language a strong language background, or foreign languages at least. You know, what is challenging about being a translator? Because in one and kind of a silly version is, well, you just sit down with the dictionary, you sit down with the book and a notepad, and a couple hours later you got the translation. What is the actual challenge for someone who's never even thought about trying to translate a book?
Well, there are many challenges. The style of each author is different. Translating a text is not a matter of just looking up words in dictionaries and finding one-to-one correspondences beyond the obvious complications of having idiomatic phrases and the like. There's a question of finding the musicality in each text. I like to draw an analogy between prose and music. Each author has his own particular rhythm. There's a prosody to each text, so you have to feel your way into it. And I often find that after translating the first chapter or two of a book, I want to go back and do it over again because it's taken me a while to capture the music in the author's style. So there's often this little learning period, even for an experienced translator. And then in doing scholarly translation, there's the additional challenge of a certain technical vocabulary that varies from subject to subject. And I've covered quite a range of subjects over the course of my career. If you want to make a living as a translator, you have to develop a kind of expertise in more than one subject because there are not enough books being produced in a single subject area. So it requires a certain amount of ancillary reading in both English and French beyond the book that you're actually translating. You need to read similar books in French to get a sense of the peculiarities of each author's approach. And then books in English so that you pick up the technical vocabulary in each field and the way the book that you're translating relates to the community of scholarship that exists in a particular area.
I was prepping for this by reading a bunch of stuff around you translating Democracy in America, which is obviously a very famous book. And you had maybe it was a speech or a presentation where you were talking about Leo Strauss, who's a very famous, arguably conservative, Chicago person who said, you know, a translator should just be like a clerk who just sits down and the word comes in and then the word goes out in a different language. You talked a lot about how that's just like a bad way to translate because it misses so much and it's just very difficult to do. You know, I'm curious, why don't you talk a little bit about a lot of the stuff you translated recently? And then what is it like to be involved with translating kind of big stake books, for lack of a better phrase, like books that, you know, have a lot of politics and a lot of academic and non-academic debate about them?
Right. Well, first let me say a word about Strauss's philosophy of translation. For Strauss, the important texts, the ones that he was concerned with, were texts and political philosophy that spoke to one another across the generations. And he believed that those texts, for a variety of reasons, often contained an esoteric message, which the translator would have no way of interpreting. It required deep familiarity with the text and its context on the part of the scholars who would study it. So the translator, in order not to disturb that cryptic message that was supposedly contained in these texts, was obliged, according to Strauss, to be perfectly literal. And the decoding was then left to the scholars who worked on the text afterwards. The translator had no role but to transcribe the text literally from one language to another. And as I explained in my paper, I reject that philosophy. I think, first of all, it's misleading, even if there is a cryptic message, because quite often the word choices in one language or another would obscure that message for reasons having to do with the deep structure of language. So I just take a totally different approach to the problem of translation. When it comes to translating big texts, important texts that have political stakes involved, I don't think my approach is any different from those I take with the the more obscure scholarly texts. I simply try to do the best I can to form an impression of what the author is trying to do, and then to repeat that attempt on the author's part as best I can in the target language. And that's simply a matter of developing a sympathy with your author. And I don't think that that process of developing a sympathy varies depending on the stakes involved in the text. It's a matter of an intimate relation between the translator and his author.
And what are some recent projects you've been translating?
Well, I've done a lot of things, ranging from works in history. The book I did immediately after doing the Piketty book was a history of Reconstruction after the American Civil War by a young French historian named Nicolas Barrère. And that's an outlier in my career. There are not many French historians who work on American history. So it was interesting for me to do that text. Before Piketty, I had done work in political theory by Jan Elster, who's actually Norwegian in origin, but has taught at Columbia and also at the Collège de France. Before that, I did several books by Pierre Rosanvallon, a political theorist who teaches at the Collège de France and is actually also a publisher who publishes a series of books in France, including the works of Thomas Piketty. That, in fact, is how I got connected with Piketty originally, because Pierre had liked my work on his books and recommended me to Piketty. So it was Piketty himself who suggested to Harvard University Press that they choose me as the translator for the book. My editor, Ian Malcolm, tells me they would have done that anyway because I had done a number of books for Harvard, and they knew that I would be a good translator for this book even before Piketty suggested it. That's how the connection came about.
So you're obviously very well known for doing a lot of political theory and books about politics. You know, Capital, which is a fantastic book. You know, I've just reviewed it for the Boston Review. If you are watching this, probably you're on the internet a lot, so you've probably seen a ton of information about it. You know, it's really interesting. It's a fantastic book. How did you start to prep for that? Can you walk us through the procedure a little bit? Because from your background, it sounds like you didn't have a lot of economics translating background, but I don't know if you had an economics background more generally. How did the prep work look? How long did it take, and what was involved with it?
Well, the Piketty book was unusual in the following respect. I was diagnosed with cancer in October of 2012, and that was just after I had agreed to do the Piketty book. So for the next 8 months, I was pretty much involved full-time with my cancer treatment, and after the treatment with the recovery, which involved many months being under the influence of narcotics, which made it difficult for me to read for any length of time. So, in fact, I received the news that I no longer had any active cancer cells in my body on the same day.
Congratulations, and thank God for that.
Thank you. On the same day that I was ready to go back to work translating. So there was not a lot of specific preparation for the Piketty. I do have a fairly good background in economics. I've read a lot of economics, and since I know mathematics, I'm capable of reading quite technical works in economics, and became quite, I had studied it in a subsidiary way at the time I was in graduate school, and had kept up with it somewhat since that time. But I became, again, intensely interested in economics, and particularly in macro, after the economic crisis of 2008. So at that time, I wanted to bring myself up to date on what was known in macroeconomics, and see what economists had to say before the crisis, and then how economic theory was adjusting in the wake. So by the time I came to translate Piketty some 5 years later, I had done quite a bit of reading in what turned out to be more fields of economics that were more deeply involved in the mathematical techniques that Piketty explicitly rejects. In fact, there was an amusing episode, when I first began to work on the book, I asked Thomas what mathematical software I should get, what he had used to represent the mathematical formulas that I expected to find in his book. And he said, actually, you won't need any special software. I've decided to keep the mathematics to a minimum. And that's quite a deliberate choice on my part. So don't worry about that. And in fact, that turned out to be the case. So there was no real specific preparation. I plunged right into the translation. As I was doing it, I had access to what is now referred to as the online technical appendix. You'll find many references to that in the footnotes to the book. I read the a number of papers in that that were referred to in that appendix, in particular the Piketty-Zucman book, Capital is Back, and the Atkinson Piketty-Saez paper on income inequality. So I had those papers in mind and had access to some of the other material in the appendix as I was translating the book. But in fact, the book is written in a very straightforward manner. And I had the additional benefit of a small glossary of technical terms that Thomas sent me, in which he said, you might want to use these as technical equivalents for certain terms that I use in French. And then as I was translating, I was able to send each chapter to him as it was finished. And he responded to me when he had differences of opinion about this or that word choice. So that's how we worked in quite close cooperation as I was proceeding.
Yeah, let's back up for 1 second. The book itself is about 600 pages of text and then endnotes. But, you know, it's written that I think is in a very accessible way. I mean, it's work. You have to put the time into it. But it's not technical language. It's not academic language. It's language that a, you know, interested, educated person can go through and understand completely. But what's interesting is that, you know, Piketty, and along with a lot of his coworkers, have done the work of assembling the database. So the book is really, in large part, a book about data and, you know, historical economic data going back, you know, centuries and millennia. But, you know, he has a real body of work that is theoretical and densely technical about, you know, why we should tax capital. A lot of economists think it's a bad idea to tax capital, period, because, you know, for very technical reasons about how, you know, you'll necessarily collapse economic productivity. And he responds to them in the most technical ways. And you also see it, you mentioned it in the Zucman paper about whether or not capital will eat a bigger share of the economy. He has, you know, a fairly, you know, the kind of like as we were discussing about math, when you get to the graduate level, it kind of cranks up in difficulty. Economics is the same way. It really amps up in this kind of convex optimization math. And so he has his technical chops down cold. You know, he's like an MIT professor in his early 20s. But the book, you know, it's kind of backgrounded, and you can easily find it through the online appendix for people who really want that. But I thought that was a really interesting and very positive choice. Did Thomas give you kind of a sense of why he approached it that way?
Yes, he wanted to reach a large audience and to bring his work and the work of his collaborators into the public debate. He wanted very consciously to make a political intervention in France and to have an influence on the way in which the response to the crisis was being discussed. In doing so, I think he was encouraged very strongly by Pierre Rosanvallon, his publisher and the political theorist to whom I referred earlier.
He wrote a book called Society of Equals, which I think you also translated. Is that right?
Yes, that's his most recent book, and it's
I just read that. It's really fascinating.
It's going to be reviewed by Paul Starr in the next issue of the New York Review of Books. So I will have had the honor of being reviewed by Paul Krugman in one issue and then by Paul Starr for a different book in a subsequent issue, which is quite interesting. The Rosenblum book came out earlier and has attracted much less attention than the Piketty, but it's equally interesting and has an equally deep historic perspective, but without the economic data. It's from a political theory point of view. So, Pierre has made a number of efforts to reach out to a public beyond the academic audience that his books ordinarily reach. He's organized a conference in conjunction with Le Monde that took place in Grenoble in 2010, and I had the pleasure of attending that conference. He also makes frequent appearances on radio and television. So he, too, is trying to have an influence on political debate in France, and I think he encouraged Thomas to work in that direction.
So what were, you mentioned you had a glossary of words, and you probably had some words you remember as being particularly interesting and difficult, and I'm curious if you could walk through some of them that were weird. I'm going to throw out a few that I was wondering if there were weird translations. One is the concept of a rentier, which is obviously has a deep history in France, but in the U.S., the use of it is kind of slippery and it often refers to a lot of different things. Or the concept of rents, period, which tends to be really focused in land debates among certain economists. I'm also curious about the word wealth, because several economists here have pointed out, for better or worse, that the analysis mushes together wealth that is physical wealth, like, you own a factory or you own a tractor, and then financial wealth, which is you own stocks and you own a claim on the land, which is valued at a certain thing in a market. I'm curious if, words like that particularly were interesting to translate.
Let me dispatch quite quickly the first question about rentier, which is the French pronunciation. The word has come over into English, and I think we use it in the same way that the French do. The 19th century use referred not only to rents from land, but to the interest derived on government bond payments, and those were very predictable returns on capital, so that Thomas makes quite a big deal out of the fact that what you got in return on your capital was quite stable over the course of the 19th century. You'd buy a government bond that would pay 3% or 4% or 5%, depending on what it was. In England, those were perpetual bonds, so you could keep them forever and reap that stable return. So a fortune could be specified either in terms of the rent that it provided, the steady return on the investment in capital, or on the amount of the capital. And so it was no problem to keep that word in English because the word exists in English and connotes the same thing that it does in French, so we kept it that way. Now, the question of wealth versus capital is indeed a vexed question. And Thomas explicitly told me that I could use the word patrimoine, which is his word for wealth, and capital, the French word for capital, interchangeably. This comes up in particular in the translation of the capital-revenu ratio, as it's called in French, or the capital-income ratio in English. Now, the problem arises because, as you say, there are different forms of capital, and it's possible to when using capital instead of wealth, particularly in the phrase capital income ratio, the problem is that in English that suggests a particular theory of economic growth associated with Robert Solow, who uses that particular ratio in his theory. The important point here is that Piketty's work does not depend in any way on Solow's growth theory. So it's unfortunate in a way that I chose, with Piketty's approval and suggestion, to translate capital income ratio as capital income ratio. I should have translated it as wealth income ratio. I think as Robert Solow himself suggested in his New Republic review, that might have avoided a certain amount of confusion.
Yeah, I think very early on, like within the first couple of pages, it says we're going to use capital and wealth interchangeably.
Right.
Go ahead.
Having said that, I think there would still remain a problem because Thomas does combine different kinds of wealth that are not normally combined in many versions of capital theory and economics. In particular, he includes housing wealth in his measure of economic wealth, of capital. Now, whether that is a source of confusion or not will remain for critics to sort out. He's already had a certain number of criticisms from French economists who have picked up on this point and who raise questions about the way he measures housing wealth and the income that is derived from housing wealth. I'm not going to go into all those technicalities here. Suffice it to say that Thomas has his reasons for doing it the way he did, and he thinks those reasons are important. He has responses to his critics, and I think those responses have to be heard out and measured against the criticisms, as any work of scholarship will attract certain criticisms. I think the criticism that he's attracted from the left, that he's embraced the solo growth theory and neglected the objections to solo growth theory that were raised by certain economists in Cambridge, England, in the mid-1950s, in particular, Joan Robinson, Pierre Straffa, Luigi Passinetti, and other theorists in the Cambridge Capital Controversy. I think those particular objections are misguided, and it will remain to see what Thomas wants to reply or not to reply to those critics.
Right. So to give a background, I'm going to use an example. My friend Seth Ackerman kind of pointed out as a shorthand for the Cambridge capital controversy. Basically, it's a very complicated debate. We're not going to get into it here. But, you know, when economists can think in terms of like apples, right? And if you add up apples, you can think of supply and demand of apples. And if you have a bunch of apples, the price should fall because, you know, the supply curve shifts out. The question is whether or not the capital infrastructure of the country operates like apples, or whether or not there's something different about the way that machinery can kind of create more demand for labor, and whether or not it substitutes in the same way, whether or not you can kind of use this very simple model of, you know, a simple object that you buy and sell at a grocery store to represent the economy as a whole. And, you know, it's an interesting read, and it's by far not the most interesting criticism of the book, I think, because in some ways, he, Piketty, as I read him, as I read the text, is basically trying to address criticisms preemptively. So he kind of adopts the language of the solo growth model at one point in one chapter to say, you know, okay, so if you think the world works this way, I think it's pretty obvious that the numbers work out so that we still have a problem, that the elasticity of substitution is greater than one is the technical term. But that I think if you look at the historical data and the way capital is likely to evolve, you know, on your terms, we still have a problem here. You know, if your terms were right, maybe this problem would kind of solve itself, but it probably won't. And a lot of people jump on that and say, like, look, he's using their language, where to me, it's a much more ambiguous and playful kind of dialogue he has with, you know, preemptively trying to address critics. And I don't know if that was your read as well.
Yes, I think in that particular place that you point out, where he's talking about the substitution of capital for labor, he's giving a plausibility argument to say that in the future, and he's not primarily concerned with the future, he's written, as he puts it, a work of history, which gives some suggestive ideas for thinking about the future. But taking his historical data, he offers some idea about where he thinks we're going in the future, and he gives a plausibility argument in which he borrows that language of neoclassical economics. But his major case does not rest on that in any way, and I think you've explained that point very well. You could also look to the criticism that has been given by another economist, more in the neoclassical tradition, like Brad DeLong, who says that many of us who work in my tradition, the neoclassical tradition, which is the mainstream, have problems with this or that aspect of the book. We disagree with 10 or 20% of it, But for each of us, it's a different 10 or 20%. And we're still trying to put together our different objections and see what we come out with as what's left of the argument. But still, for many people, there are various aspects of the argument that they are still grappling with, but many pieces of it remain convincing to them.
Are you, what else was interesting about translating? I'm curious what other things, you know, stumbled, or you're still a little uncertain if it could have gone this way or that way? Because the book reads, as you mentioned, like very cleanly, like it's meant for a general audience, but obviously that hides a lot of work in translation.
No, for me, it was a book that was written with extreme clarity, and it was actually, despite its technicalities, easier to translate than most of the books I translate, because the style was quite straightforward. Often you have to twist and turn and stretch and compress the French sentence to make it work in English. And with Piketty, that wasn't necessary. There was much less chiseling and hammering that was necessary to come up with a clean English style that corresponded in what I thought was a faithful way to what he had done in French. There were a few places where I thought he might have written more compactly, and occasionally I made suggestions to him, but his judgment was that it was necessary to have a certain amount of repetition to remind the reader of the argument, the reader where the argument had been before. His point was that most readers were not going to be spending as much time over the book as I was, and wouldn't have fixed as firmly in their minds points that he had made in earlier chapters. So for those readers, he felt it was necessary to repeat points he had already made, whereas my suggestion was cut this or that. And usually he resisted those objections, and I think in retrospect, he was probably right.
Let's stick with the criticisms for a minute. I wrote a Boston Review review of it, which kind of tried to summarize for a layperson what the general criticisms were. And on the right, though it's not really a right-wing critique per se, you know, there's a concern that it's not tied closely to economic models. But on the broader left, and it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be a left critique, you know, there's a concern about, I'll phrase it a little bit more differently. There's a concern about what actually brought about a transition to equality. So to back off, we should probably state a little bit of the thesis. One is that, and I think the data here shines, is that, you know, we had a very unequal society at the beginning of the 20th century. And it looked like that through the Industrial Revolution. And it looked like that over a longer period of time, even going back further. And a lot of the things we're concerned about, the capital stock relative to current income, how much the wealth of the past is relevant to the wealth of the present and the future, the capital share, how much all income in our economy goes to either workers or capital, and, you know, how much of it goes to capital, it was a great deal for capital at the beginning of the 20th century. In the middle of the 20th century, that inequality collapsed, and it was a much better deal for workers. And now we're turning back to the numbers of the old way. And, you know, that's obviously something to be worried about. One criticism that I'm interested in particularly your impression of it, because, you know, as a translator, you kind of watch the thoughts very closely. What was it that changed things for the mid-century period? Because on a quick read of the book, he plays up the wars very intensely, that there was the actual destruction of people who couldn't inherit things, destruction of things, the Great Depression collapsed a lot of businesses and claims on the economy, and that kind of shook everything up. My personal read on the text is that the wartime economies, the wartime mobilizations, things like wage scales and a high progressive income tax and essentially the ownership of capital by the state to mobilize in war was really important. But Bob Kuttner just wrote a big thing in the American Prospect saying, you know, we really have to look at labor unions and public utility law and social democratic reforms as being a much bigger player than what comes across in the text. I'm curious how you see those debates evolving.
Yes, I think we're going to see a lot of response to the book on the part of political scientists and historians, because, and I think Thomas will consider that the most wonderful outcome that he could have from the book. That what he calls for repeatedly is less isolation of economics from the other social sciences. He gives as one of his reasons for returning to France after his period of teaching at MIT early in his career, his desire to work more closely with historians and social scientists who he thinks are less isolated from economists in France than they are in the United States. I think, as you point out, that there is a lack of discussion in the book, despite Thomas's interest in saying more about what actually happened historically and politically in the period of transition that he singles out in his data. He doesn't really do that in the book, and he's not perhaps equipped to do that because it's not his training. His field of expertise is economics and not history, not political science. So I am familiar with Bob Kuttner's review, and I've spoken to Bob at length about the book. I agree with many and probably most of the points that he makes. And I agree with the remarks that you've just made. Thomas says quite explicitly that destruction of physical capital accounts for only a small percentage of the decline in the capital income ratio that occurs in the interwar period. I think he says it's only about 10%. So the rest of it has to do with other political phenomena. Strengthening labor unions is one of those. A change in the relative bargaining power of various professions is another. Realignment of power of interest groups forming political coalitions is extremely important. In France, after the war, the old elite was discredited by its collaboration during wartime and therefore swept away in the post-1945 period, which made possible a number of political reforms that strengthened the hand of labor unions and reduced the free hand of the owners of capital to decide on how they were going to make their investments. And this is one of the things that led to the new dynamics of the post-war period. So all of these things are pointed to in Thomas' data, but he doesn't examine in any way the political and social phenomena that underlie the changes that his data suggest. So I think in the next couple of years, we're going to see an enormous amount of work in this area, precisely because of the immense amount of interest that his book has attracted.
Yeah, I mean, most economists kind of assume it's a natural process that a rich economy will gravitate to the kind of equality we've had in the mid-century period. But obviously, that's not the case. I think that's one of the most important contributions of the book.
Absolutely, and I think it's one of the key points to make in response to those who say that he's an adept of solo-style growth theory. Because solo's growth theory says that the capital share of national income should not vary. It's determined by an exponent in the production function. And that's clearly not the case in Thomas' work. All of his work goes to show that there have been substantial variations in the capital share of income. So he's clearly not a solo growth theorist.
And one thing you pointed out that actually really stuck out for me in the book, because I read a lot of economics. I did not finish a PhD in economics because, as you mentioned earlier, I did not want to focus on just one thing in an academic setting. But crucially, I love the dialogue and the kind of reaching out to other disciplines and also the general population, because a lot of economics writings, especially before the crisis, has this kind of reductionist, almost arrogance about how, well, this simple idea of incentives can explain everything and, in fact, explains all of history or sociology or politics. And it's, you know, I understand there's a kind of people in the academy call it like economic imperialism, which, you know, the techniques and ideas of economics kind of spill across all the boundaries, where I think he is really reaching out and, you know, consciously asking for help in solving these big, difficult issues, which I found very refreshing. I mean, you maybe could have taken it out and would still been in the same book, but I think it's a little point that I thought was showed a very genuine intellectual curiosity, which I was very impressed with.
Yes, I think he is genuinely trying to reach out. And shortly after his book came out in France, a debate was organized at Sciences Po, where his book was discussed by a sociologist, a historian, and an economist. It was quite an interesting discussion. You can find it on the internet if you search for it.
So one question, you bring it up, that obviously it was in France. It came out in France last year sometime?
Yes, in October.
October, what, in moving the book from France to the United States, was there any kind of context you were worried about losing? For instance, from my read of the text, it was the global wealth tax. I understand Thomas, when he is touring America, talking about the book, he's still very much pushing it as a solution. But to me, it struck me as a very EU-specific solution. And in the text, you see there's a couple of points where he brings it up and then says, this is very difficult, and it's like a, you know, it's a generational problem to try to solve. But in the meantime, the EU could go ahead with some stuff, and that would be very helpful, because there the idea of tax competition is obviously a much bigger issue, though it's still obviously an issue in the United States. Is there are there solutions or dialogues or conversations you were worried that a French reader would pick up that a United States or an American reader would not?
No, not really. It's true that there are moments when he alludes to a discussion that is more prominent in the public debate in Europe, and his solution, I think, might have greater feasibility in Europe, as you suggest. The biggest difference, I think, is the one that Paul Krugman pointed out, that there is a difference in the inequality phenomenon itself in the United States, in that the, or perhaps in the United States and the UK, in that the disparities at the top end of the income distribution are greater in the United States. This phenomenon that Thomas refers to as super salaries among super managers is one that exists in the United States and not in France or in Germany. Then there's also the fact that, I think as you pointed out in your review, that in Germany, the data on capital are somewhat different because you have a stakeholder situation in Germany where the trade unions sit on the boards of corporations in the under the Mitbestimmung system, and therefore the capital value has not been inflated as much as it has in the Anglo-Saxon countries. So there are those differences, but they don't figure prominently in Thomas' arguments, and I think he covers the cross-country differences sufficiently in his discussion that there was nothing in particular that I worried about. The problem of translating from one community of reference to another has been much greater in other books that I've translated than in this one, where I think the inequality debate has been sufficiently prominent in the United States, in part because of Thomas' own work, not this work, but his previous work with Emmanuel Saez on incomes. So that there's been enough discussion of the problem of inequality in the United States that I did not expect this book to come as a surprise to American readers.
So this is a good way to segue to the huge success. I mean, as we speak right now, I believe it's sold out on Amazon. It was one of the bestseller on Amazon. It's gotten a huge amount of critical attention. I've heard, and it's not just a coastal thing, I've heard stories about various towns in the Midwest have like 100 people on the waiting list for the public library. I'm curious, is this I know you've translated some books that obviously have a built-in audience, like Democracy in America, where you can tell it's going to be a big deal. But I'm curious, is this the kind of new translation or a book of a translation of a new book that has been the biggest for you? And what do you think has been behind the huge wave of success for it?
Well, it's by far the biggest seller in my entire career. In fact, by the end of it, it may have sold more than all the other books I've translated combined.
Is that true?
No, I'm exaggerating, but I've translated 125 books, and none has come close to this. Democracy in America, over its lifetime, the translation may sell something close to this, but the initial sales were nothing like this. The book that came closest previously was probably one or two of the books in the History of Private Life series, which came close to being a bestseller, but I don't think made the New York Times bestseller list. So one or two of them may have been, there were five volumes in that series. One or two of them may have been on the Amazon top 100 for a while, but not Amazon number one like this one. And the publisher, too, was taken by surprise. I mean, we had expected this to be an academic hit, which means perhaps sales of 20,000, but it sold 20,000 in the first few weeks. And the publication date had been moved up because of the advanced publicity that the book had received even before it came out. So the publisher was totally taken by surprise, and that's why there have been shortages on Amazon and elsewhere. They've now rushed many tens of thousands of more books into print, and I think the shortages are beginning to be alleviated. I just heard from a friend today that he had received his Amazon order. So
I know there was a wait list for reviewers of it, right? So normally the publisher tries to get it to the reviewers, but reviewers are like prominent sites were having trouble getting a review copy. It was so in demand.
Yes. So there was quite an unexpected initial demand for the book, and it's been totally extraordinary. How do I explain that? I don't really have a good explanation. I've heard many. It obviously comes at a crucial moment in our inequality debate, but there are many people who've been writing about inequality, and I'm not sure why this particular book has suddenly caught on. It obviously is backed by a massive amount of data, and that makes it unassailable, or at least difficult to assail in ways that other kinds of research might not be. And it's written, as you've pointed out, in a very accessible style. It attracted a lot of early attention, and he's quite good at presenting the book, as he did in a number of public appearances, and has been quite patient in answering the questions of innumerable interviewers. I would have lost patience by now answering the same question over and over again, but he's quite willing to do that, and I think wants to be a proselytizer for his own work. So that has helped. And the fact that many journalists have been eager to cover the book for whatever reason, they can answer that question better than I can, has surely helped bring it to the attention of many.
Excellent. Well, I think, is there any final words you'd like to share about the book? I mean, I highly recommend people check it out, read the reviews, but in the meantime, while you're waiting for more books to hit the libraries and hit the bookstores, I think it was, it's a sizable book, and it was a sizable investment of time, but I thought it was worth it. I thought it really expanded, and I hope it expands the way we talk about economics, because so much of economic discourse is really an elite discourse, and it's really kind of not accessible or understandable to outsiders on purpose. And I thought the very democratic and egalitarian spirit of the book itself is present on every page. And I thought the translation helped with that as well. I mean, as you said, it was you found it to be a straightforward thing in many places, but it reads as something that invites people to engage with it. So thank you on behalf of everyone for translating it. And is there any final comments you want to share?
Well, I think you've put it in an excellent way, that the book is written with a democratic spirit. That's what struck me from the beginning. I think that's very much intentional on Thomas's part. He's obviously someone who can take part in the technical discussions of economics at the very highest level. The fact that he was chosen, a rare thing among French economists, by MIT at the age of 21 or 22, to come teach at MIT, shows that he was an exceptional economist in that very technical conversation. But for many reasons, it didn't satisfy him. And I think one of those reasons is political, that he thinks that economics should be part of the public debate in a political way that in which everyone can engage, so that it should not be reserved to experts fighting one another with arcane technical formulas. And I think that his intention was to make a broader, more public debate possible. He says at many points that he doesn't want his opinion to be taken as an expert opinion. He doesn't think that if there should be a global wealth tax, that its level should be decided by a paper that he writes together with Saez that says this is the optimal tax level. No, he's inviting other people to weigh in and offer their opinions on how they think such a tax should be levied and whether it should be levied at all.
There's a great moment in National Review where they had an economist review it, and it was very telling because he's a straightforward economist. But he's like, Piketty has no theory of the optimal level of inequality determined by an economic model. And it's like, yeah, he doesn't. He really does not do that. And the fact that an economist just assumes that that's what you should do to talk about it, I thought was so telling.
Right. It's not what he wants to do. And I think what he wants to do is to bring economics back to what it was in the 19th century when it was called political economy and it was a moral science rather than a would-be physical science pretending to uncover laws of nature. I think he wants to show that it has a moral aspect, which means that it's part and parcel of our political conversation. So to the extent that this book succeeds in doing that, I think he will regard his work as a success, and I'll consider my contribution to that a contribution to the well-being of our polity.
How was translating the phrase political economy? Was that straightforward? Does that have a complicated history?
No, that has the same history in French as in English, so that was not a problem.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time, Art, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay, my pleasure, Mike. Take care.